Okay.
Welcome back to This Is Not
a History
Lecture.
Who?
We've had a busy day over here working, yeah. Grinding. We're doing the good old capitalist try here against our wills. But you can't survive in America without giving into the capitalism somehow. Basically, I'm just mad that I have to work right now. That's really what this is.
Yeah.
I'm burned out.
But, and I mean, you've got some big news on the horizon. I'm gonna let you say it if you want to. So
I will wait like another week or two till I have like the physical tangible. Yeah. Just in case.
So tune in for the next couple episodes. Yeah. Your cat's big announcement.
Yeah. Big stuff happening in life and all that jazz.
All good things. All good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good things.
So I am one drink in.
Vibing.
So I'm doing great. It's Friday night.
It is a Friday night.
No complaints.
Mm-hmm.
Was kind of gross this morning. Pretty humid. But wind kicked in and blew all that out, and now it was a beautiful day. What?
I walked out this morning, and I was like, what a beautiful day.
This morning?
Yes!
When it was, like, you were swimming?
It was, like, about to rain, and
maybe
I was like,
you should live in Houston.
I should have lived in Houston. Oh, my God. But Muggy...
You're the only one I know who appreciates...
Muggy is, like, being wrapped in a blanket.
God.
I don't like the, like, hot Muggy... But warm Muggy is nice.
It was like, oh, God. Do you hear what you're saying?
Yes, and I know it sounds so bad.
It's like someone's like breathing but on you all day.
But for someone who's perpetually cold all the time, you know, it's just so nice.
I was talking to my coworker, and she used to be cold like you are.
Mm-hmm.
And she said something that I think is true for you, too, that when you are like that cold all the time, it's not just heat that makes you warm. It's like warm heat. It's like you need the moisture element.
Yes.
And that reminded me of you and your bass that you would fall asleep in.
Yes. The only time I ever truly feel warm is in warm water.
Yeah.
Like hot tub, bath, anything.
She's like, I would have to take like a shower.
Yeah. Feeling warm. Yeah. No, 100%. And I talked to a friend of mine who has a similar medical condition the other day. I mentioned to it. Trisha's just like, oh yeah, no, you have to have a bathtub. Like, you just have to with our condition because, it is the only time you ever feel truly warm.
Well, if you ever want to, you know, clean the bath and take a bath, go for it.
Hot showers help. Okay. But, like it's just weird because it's, like, muggy outdoor weather is the closest.
I just won't allow you to, like, fall asleep in my bathtub. We're not doing that here.
No, we don't need that risk, that liability.
No, you're not going to die in my apartment.
Ooh, a haunted forever.
They're going to, like, the leasing guy's going to be like, what the fuck? She wasn't on the lease. Like, that's just my friend who takes a bath here sometimes.
I would haunt this apartment. It would be really funny. It would. But yeah, like muggy outdoor weather is the closest you get to actually feeling like stable almost. Because
you
like
should move to Houston because that you will have more of that than you ever
I know
ever will need. Ever.
I will admit, once it gets a little too hot, like in the direct sun, if there's direct sun on you, then the mugginess is gross. But if it's like cloudy with muggy, ooh, that's nice.
Kat, that's literally every day in Houston. I want you to know that. I know that you haven't spent like a substantial amount of time in Houston, but
the time I've spent with my family there has been nice when I visit my cousins. I will admit that. Maybe I should be looking.
There's a lot of people who move between Dallas and Houston. So
I know. Maybe I'll look into it. I gotta look into it.
Not too far from your family.
Yeah. I have cousins and aunt and uncle there.
Right. My brother is in Dallas right now too, so he did it.
That's true. He's a transplant.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
nice. Well, yeah.
You can try finally see the real truth of what the best city in Texas is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's not get into that right now. For those of you all listening that don't know, Dallas and Houston have a little bit of a rivalry, but no one actually cares.
No
I don't
one actually
think.
Cares except when it's fun to talk about.
Exactly.
And sports.
Yes.
People care about sports.
Yes. But the Dallas Cowboys suck, so like...
That's true.
So I don't know why.
So
there's no winning.
Yeah, but I'll still be a Texas fan until I die.
I won't be a Cowboys fan. I've performed in their stadium and I still
I graduated in the Houston Texans stadium.
I think I graduated in... My sister graduated in the Star.
Yeah.
Like, we all, I marched there, I performed there.
Riddle me this, Kat. Is there a bar in Dallas that does turtle races?
I don't know.
Tell me what the best city in Texas is.
You might have won with that one, actually. But yeah.
So, other than that, I mean.
It's been a good time here in Texas.
Yeah.
It's about the closest we get to spring.
Yeah. Are like 3 days of spring and then it's just summer
and then and it's like a muggy like weird weather for like 3 weeks.
It's gross. It, like, so. Can't decide if it wants to rain, and then it never does. And it's like, God, I would put up with this if it would just rain.
But you can lock yourself in your room, look at the clouds, and say, oh, I'm going to pretend it's raining and it's a rainy day, and lie to yourself about it.
I do that a lot. I used to do that. Or, well, I'm not used to, but like when it's hot out, but like you can. You're like, lock yourself in your room and you pretend. Can like see the breeze and you're like, the air conditioning's blowing. You're like, I'm going to pretend it's like a cool,
it's a cool winter
67. It's like, ooh, it's so nice out.
Yep.
So
the
things we do to cope here. Yep. Here in good old Texas.
Great state of Texas. Mm-hmm. Well,
oh man.
Anything else big for you?
No, it's honestly been a chill week. I'm going to take Monday off, which is exciting.
Nice.
I'm just going to go in for a meeting. So
good. I know you had you had an extra work day this past weekend, so it'll be a good little balancing act.
Unfortunately, I'm so dramatic
Holy
about
cow.
It.
Oh, that scared me.
It's a cat.
He went for my hair. It was dangling through the slats of the chair, and he went for my braid.
He is, sorry.
You're good. That just scared me. I was like, what just tried to climb up my hair? I was so...
anything dangling, and then black socks. Black socks are like his enemy number one.
Interesting.
Will attack anyone wearing black socks.
I've made a point not to wear them after I found that out.
Well, see, I appreciate that from you. Not that I'm asking you to like alter your behavior, but my roommate's boyfriend always wears black socks, and then he always acts surprised. He's like, oh, Appa, what are you doing? I don't know, dude. You've been coming over with him here for 2 years.
You know about the socks.
Every time he attacks your black socks.
I know better.
I wonder what's happening.
I have plenty of not black socks, so I've just been wearing those. But yeah. So cool. Then we can
let's jump right in. Get on.
Awesome sauce. So my topic today,
dun, dun, dun.
I chose this because it was mentioned briefly in Cal's last week, not a lecture. Yes. About Boudica.
Yes.
And I had mentioned even during that Nero has been on my list for a while. And I finally bit the bullet and did it. It was not as intimidating as I thought it was going to
be.
I felt good about it. I think I felt so overwhelmed because, again, it's one of those topics that unless you like really know the classics, it was kind of like doing the pre-Columbian Mesoamerica. Like, it's just it feels overwhelming. But when you really break it down into small pieces, it's a little more okay. So it's still a biography. So that was easier than if I had done like ancient Rome.
Oh my gosh, can you imagine?
Yeah. So I would also like to acknowledge that one of the first search results I had was the World History article from the World History Encyclopedia. And
God,
we
love,
know how we feel about
I
World
love
History Encyclopedia.
World History Encyclopedia. Literally, when I was doing Boudica last week.
Bless them.
I was like, I know. Because they don't have an article for everything.
No.
But with her, I was like, I know they have one. And they did. Their, and I was like, come through.
Their articles on Mesoamerica, I was like, you're just beautiful.
Amazing.
We stan World History Encyclopedia articles.
Big fan.
So I do want to attribute a lot of my research today to them. They did a great comprehensive history on Nero. So a lot of my information does come from that.
And they have good quotes.
They do.
Like stuff from
well-written, evenly paced.
And
they just do such a good job.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So quick recap summary. If you don't know anything about Nero and you don't know if you want to listen to my topic today, he was a Roman emperor who was famous for his intrigue and his opulent lifestyle, as well as sort of devolving into what is debatably a not healthy state of mind and cruelty. Mm-hmm. He's arguably best known for the burning of Rome that occurred under his reign as the fifth Roman emperor.
Okay.
So that's a quick little recap on Nero. We're just going to start from his birth, as we do often in biographies. Nero is Nero is a Roman emperor, obviously, but he was not born necessarily into the direct line. Like, he was not next in line for the throne originally.
Okay.
December 15th in 37 CE. So it was really fun reading dates
December
as double
15th.
Digits because it always throws me off.
Yeah, it's really
weird.
When you're just like, oh, back in 37.
And you're like, that doesn't feel right.
and then you have to like,
you're missing two
pause.
Numbers.
It's like last week when I was like, oh, they attacked in the 40s.
Like,
Do you mean the
1940s? No. No, just the 40s.
Just the 40s.
Yep. It's weird. Originally, Nero is born as Lucius Domitius Ahenobarbus to his mother. His mother is, I believe, the name Agrippa. Is that how you...
Yeah.
So hers is written Agrippina, but I think it would be Agrippina.
Yeah, probably.
When it's in the longer form. And I listened to pronunciations online. I'm still not sure if it was a British accent versus, like, how it was being said.
It's like, I'm not going to say how the Brits say it.
And the INA makes me think it's Agrippina.
Okay.
So it is spelled like Agrippa with INA on the end.
Okay.
But this, again, we are getting into old royal families. So bear with me on the family tree here. Because his mother, Agrippina, Agrippina, was the daughter of Agrippina the Elder, which makes her the granddaughter of Julia, who was the daughter of Emperor Julius.
Okay.
So you're
she's like...
She's the great-granddaughter of that. Julius. Yes, okay. She's a great-granddaughter of Julius.
Gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. Following. Good. Cool. Okay.
In theory.
Yeah. The whole family is... What is it they joke about? The family tree is really just a circle. there's like a saying for that. But the whole family, I think there's something to be had about the conversation of nurture versus nature in this family. Also, when you have married into a family a lot of the time, there can be some issues with genetics getting a little questionable. I don't know how to say that delicately. Just don't keep marrying your first cousins.
Yeah, don't do that.
Yeah.
There's a TikTok I saw today, and I knew this was a thing, but I had forgot. Apparently in Iceland, because the population's so little, they literally have an app to make sure that you don't date your cousin, like, accidentally.
I've heard of that.
Yeah.
I've heard of, like, the precautions.
And someone was like, Iceland is just Alabama. Don't y'all have an app?
Oh, no!
Oh, my God.
That is the joke about the South. So
specifically.
Specifically
Alabama.
So, Agrippina and her grandmother, along with some of Agrippina's own siblings, were literally starved to death. As, like, punishment from one of, like, the emperors and rulers. And so, like, this is a brutal time period. The royal family is not... There's a lot of, like, intrigue and betrayal. And it's very Game of Thrones-esque.
Yeah.
Which I believe Game of Thrones is based after War of the Roses. But there's some stuff going on in this time period where I'm like, you sure you aren't, like, just describing the plot of Thrones?
Right.
Doesn't help.
It was like that one topic we did a couple weeks ago where we're like, this has got to be
This has got to be inspiration for it. Yeah. Because he based... R.R. Martin based... I think it's War of the Roses.
It was the Medici's.
The Medici's. Yeah. Ah.
Well, no. He based it off of War of the Roses. And we were like, there's no way it's not about the Medici's.
Yes.
And some people have, like, drawn comparisons, but he hasn't said that he's based it off of the Medici's. Gotcha. Which I'm wondering if it's just... He just hasn't said it, but did it anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. So if you want to talk about, like, the genetics of the family, Agrippina, her younger brother was Caligula.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
So Caligula is Nero's uncle.
Okay.
Like, that is how interlaced we all are.
I remember this. Yeah.
So there's a lot of discussion, again, about nature versus nurture, because his birth father, his genetic, Nero's genetic biological father, was very abusive and violent. His name was Gnaeus Domitius Ahenobarbus. He died when Nero was only 3, somewhere around 40 CE. So that kind of, you know, obviously Nero's later evolution into kind of a cruel person wasn't directly influenced, because his father was dead by the time he was 3. So that's not so much nurture, but there's a chance he got it genetically through nature.
Well, then, you know, even though you might not have memories of that,
it's still very formative. Yes,
you know?
Yes, that is true. His father, biological father, was known to have killed a child in their local village by running him over with a chariot.
Oh my God.
Yeah, like cruel, cruel, violent man. Jeez. And he hated Nero. So, like you said, even if he doesn't really remember, I'm sure that Nero received a lot of his ire as a child. He literally told his wife, Agrippina, that Nero, the son, would be a disaster because of who Agrippina was, because of, like, how she was as a person and her lineage and everything. So, like, very abusive situation early on. Around the same time that Nero was born, the current emperor, Claudius, of the Julio-Claudian dynasty, murders his third wife, Messalina. This is completely, like, this is adults. Like, the current emperor murders his third wife. Okay. He managed to do it by accusing her of adultery and treason. I'm not sure how accurate that was, or if it was just a way to get rid of his wife.
Right.
But it contributes to why this whole empire is so hard to follow, because Agrippina is like, hey, Claudius, that dude over there, the emperor, just killed his wife. You know what I would love to be?
His wife.
His wife.
Jesus.
So she already has Nero as a son. Her husband's dead. She's like, time to move in on the emperor. Let's do this. Let's try.
We love a woman with ambition, though.
Well, we do, until we realize that they start hanging out. And I was like, oh, cool. Like, I guess, you know, go for power however you want it, I guess. Claudius, I just realized, like, it took three different articles before I realized Claudius is her uncle.
Oh, not that much ambition.
Yeah. We're not going to girl boss that hard.
No.
Yeah.
Girl boss a little too close to the sun.
We're too close to the sun. And she gets in his good graces, and she marries her uncle, the Emperor Claudius, in 49 CE. God. At which point, Nero's name is changed to Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus. And about a year later, Nero is officially adopted by his new father at the urging of his mother.
Okay.
So, okay. By both, technically, by his stepfather and his mother, he has lineage in the, like, Julio, like, the whole bloodline.
Right. Okay.
So, Nero is only 17 when he comes to power and sits on the throne.
Oh,
the emperor's throne. This is where it starts to sound a lot like Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
And I was watching Game of Thrones this week. So, like, I'm
it's on the mind.
I'm probably, like, what is the projecting a little bit. But
also, I don't think anyone's gonna blame you for saying that Game of Thrones sounds like the Roman dynasties. Like,
it really does. It's just intrigue and murder.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Like, okay, he said it's just about War of the Roses, but it's George R. R. Martin, all right? This dude does whatever he wants.
Yeah, he does what he wants. Yeah. So I say this is Game of Thrones intrigue because Emperor Claudius dies.
Okay.
Suspiciously.
Oh, I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Is there at the end of the sentence?
This is only a few years into his new marriage.
Hmm.
In 54 CE, it is said that he died after eating a bowl of mushrooms, which were very likely poisonous. But at this point, no one is confusing what mushrooms are poisonous and not. Like, right. They know how to cook.
You're the literal emperor. It's not like you don't have, like, a mushroom expert.
Exactly. Like, you're not picking stuff up out of the forest on your little, like, walk and being like, ooh, let's eat the mushroom. That's why it's very suspicious, is that it's poisoning. And it's almost certain that someone would have had to purposefully, someone would have had to purposefully give him something poisonous. And what's even more suspicious is that Nero later says that mushrooms are, quote, food of the gods, end quote.
Oh, so
Nero really likes mushrooms. Interesting. And it's thought
food of the gods to do their will.
Exactly. It's widely accepted in thought that Agrippina, however you want to say it, Aggie girl, gave Claudius the food herself and killed her husband. Knowing that that would not only put her in power, because we still have ideas about patriarchy and stuff and women in power and all that, but if she can get her son in there as the successor, she will be willing. And we see this from a lot of powerful women throughout history.
This man's already killed one of his wives.
Yep.
So who's
so the
to
best?
Say?
Yeah. It's either I kill my husband or he's going to kill me. One of us has to kill the other. And if I can kill him and my husband isn't still, and my son isn't still on the throne, I have proxy control, especially when your son's only 17.
Right.
So Claudius had a legitimate biological son as well named Britannicus. Nero and his mother have genuine concern because he has a claim to the throne. Britannicus is the biological son of the previous emperor. And it said at one point, Nero may have tried to poison him Britannicus to get him out of the way as well, afraid that the common people would rise up in support of whoever had the actual blood of Claudius in their veins.
Right, because you can't have that other contender that they can rally around either.
Exactly.
When things go south with you,
and they're only stepbrothers, so he doesn't have, I don't think he has great qualms about trying to murder his stepbrother.
They're stepbrothers and cousins. Let's be clear.
Oh my god, you're right. Yes. Or, yeah, cousins, yep.
It might be like second cousins or however that works out, but they're cousins. Yeah,
mm-hmm. But it's kind of, their worry isn't really validated because pretty quickly the people end up supporting Nero. They're like, oh, well, he's adopted. He's been like verified as the son, and he's got, it's not like he doesn't have royal blood in his veins from his mother previously and everything. So he's elected, like officially proclaimed in 54 CE. Again, still pretty young. So his mother is exerting a lot of her influence through him. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, it's interesting, a lot of the people who Nero, like, work with Nero and have power in his court, mm-hmm. owe that position in court to his mother, to Agrippina. Because, like, Nero's not picking out his counsel and advisors. Right. His mother picked them out for him years ago because he's still too young to know what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And she's kind of stacked in his favor. So they owe their positions and their loyalty really to her, but they all throw it visibly behind Nero. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a, she notices, Agrippina notices, like, hey, I gave you the position of power you're in, you owe me. But they're not really supporting her, they're supporting the official emperor.
Right.
Namely, his tutors and advisors, there's two that come up again, Burrus and Seneca. And between Seneca, Burrus, and Agrippina, it's very fair, I think, to say that those three people are really running this empire.
Okay.
Nero has a say. Nero is their puppet. Not just puppet, but you'll see later that Nero doesn't really care. Nero's not here to be emperor. He's here to vibe.
Yeah.
And these three people are really, again, thrones-level intrigue. It's all that stuff going on in the background behind closed doors.
Dude, I am picturing this right now.
This is such a cool movie.
Like, I know.
I would love to watch. I mean, there are so many movies about this kind of stuff, but
look, here's the thing. Hollywood cannot do ancient movies right.
They don't have a good track record with ancient history.
It's really hard for them for whatever reason.
I think
they try to make it like tough and gritty.
Try to make it a Hollywood version, and I'm like, the story would write itself.
This is a period piece, dude.
Yeah.
Play off of that.
I know.
What are we doing?
I know. I agree. So Nero's technically in power, and at first, the people of Rome are really optimistic about this. And you do see that quite often when someone new steps in. It's that moment of hope, that flash of like, things are going to get better. This is great. Everything feels optimistic. Uh-huh. And to be fair, among the government, he makes some very visible changes in his own favor, but in the people's favor very quickly. He hands a lot of power back to the Roman Senate, and that in itself, that kind of splitting of power, makes him seem like less of a tyrant than Claudius. Mm-hmm. So already they see this as, he's not a dictator like his predecessor. He is a new and fair person who is splitting power. He's not going to abuse it. He's letting the Roman Senate make decisions. And so he's fair. He's fair to them, is what they their first impression.
Which is so funny, because that is not what Nero goes down in history
for. No, not at all. And he directly refutes some of his father's decrees, declaring openly that his stepfather, was a fool. His stepfather had started some really corrupt things, like secret trials and stuff that weren't, like, stuff that would not fly. And he puts a stop to it. So it feels like a favor, and the people buy into it even more.
Right.
And he gets rid of capital punishment to an extent, reduced taxes. He allows slaves to bring complaints against their owners, which is kind of the bare minimum. Like, come on, people. But like for the time, that's kind of revolutionary.
Right.
And biographers and historians agree pretty much. There's not a lot of bad stuff written about his early years. This is not like some historians were like, oh, he was so great and everything. Like, we have to ask ourselves, you know, like, what was the bias? Did he have too much money and intimidate the right people and all that stuff? But
were they court historians, you know?
Yeah. We have Tacitus writing on some of this. Mm-hmm. Our man Tacitus.
Oh, who just, Tassie.
Yeah. So But we can, based on the fact that we don't see reports of a lot of bad stuff anywhere, we can assume that it's actually pretty smooth sailing for the first bit. This is a blessing to the people. He's approachable, understanding, et cetera, et cetera. He puts a lot of funding towards the arts and enjoyable things like tournaments and music. And when you start funding things like that, it really, it looks like you're ushering in a golden age of new art.
People are having a great time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it helps with the feeling of nationalism too, to an extent of like, we're creating our country. Our empire is creating beautiful things. We can be proud of this. And that's like a little mini golden age. He's having a good time. He supplied aid even to the Jewish community.
Oh.
He built improvements on infrastructure pretty early on. He even had like a savings account, almost like saved up money in case there was a natural disaster or unforeseeable circumstance. Hmm. So the people see him as like very well prepared, thinking smart. And I'm wondering also how much of this was him being young. And again, his mother and advisors making these calls, and he got all the credit for them, even though he's just the puppet and everyone else is like, you're 16, just shut up and say what we tell you to.
And then as soon as he's old enough to like take power for himself, we see a difference.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of what I wondered.
Yeah.
He loves the arts enough that it starts to dominate his life a little bit. And at the same time, he has just given the Roman Senate a great deal of power. And between that and his advisors, he's kind of like, okay, y'all got this? Great. Have fun. I'm going to play my little instrument, and I'm going to just vibe over here.
Yeah, this is like a 20-year-old dude, you know? Like,
he's
Yeah.
Who knows wealth and privilege, too. Yeah. Like, he's that dude.
Right.
And so he shirks some of his responsibilities, and he gives the Roman Senate a lot of power, not just because he thinks they should have power, but, like, because he doesn't want to do all of it himself, I don't think. And Agrippina, at this point, she's wielding her power effectively. She's very, very vocal about it too, which is interesting to me because a lot of women in history know that they have power, but they can't keep their influence quiet because they know the people aren't going to protest or someone will come after them or they'll become a target. She had no problem being like, yeah, no, I'm doing this. I got this. I got this power. I have this authority. Oops, sorry, hiccups. I have this authority. I hope this is correct. I saw it verified multiple places.
Okay.
That Nero ended up being famous for his performances in which the audience was not allowed to leave. But he was like, I'm so good at this that you're going to sit through my entire performance.
No!
No
bathroom breaks.
He would sing and play the lyre. It is reported that he was not a good singer.
Oh my God.
Like, he really thought he was something.
Oh,
but he wasn't. And when you have that much money, everyone just kind of has to do what you say anyway.
Yeah.
There's like stories surrounding his performances that go to talk about how women like went into labor. People like passed out.
Oh my God.
Like,
and he just kept going.
Apparently someone like died during one of his performances. Oh my God. He just like kept going. He's like, nope, no one's going to leave.
Oh my God.
So
emergency medical services are not allowed in.
No, we do not stop this music for anybody. I'll start the whole thing over if you interrupt.
Oh my God.
So it seems like it was kind of a meme and a joke in its own right. People were just like, oh God, you got to go to that performance? Yeah.
It was like the reaping in the Hunger Games.
And
they're like, oh God, you just have to sit through his performance.
Like the dreaded invitation to the Emperor's like lyre performance. But he does put a lot of money towards the public programs for this as well, building theaters and even taking a little bit of focus away from those bloody visceral like gladiator fights and towards the more artistic pursuits.
Oh, so he's like an indie boy.
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, that's a pretty good way to describe it.
He's got his lyre.
Yep. And so he's not completely oblivious though to the effects of power and what he wants from his power and what power could do for him. And the fact that his mother is exerting a lot of her power finally starts to kind of come to his attention. He could have more power. It has helped that Burrus and Seneca, even though they largely owe their positions to his mother, are kind of behind Nero the whole time saying like, hey, your mom, maybe she doesn't need to be around anymore. Like, aren't you a grown up now? Come on. So,
eventually got a game to play.
Yeah, Nero kind of catches on to that method of thought eventually, that vein of thought. Mm-hmm. And he starts the process of removing her from power by first moving her out of the palace, getting her away from the physical seat of power, and they force her into retirement around 5680. He removes the Praetorian Guard that was assigned to take care of her, which leaves her very open to outside influences. He bans her from certain public appearances, including gladiator fights, and he officially puts her out of commission, like, removes her from the social public life of the court in 62.
Okay.
In between that time, like, those few years between her retirement in 56 and 56 to 62, Burrus and Seneca are essentially running the empire, with Nero as their proxy. Okay. They have his ear. He kind of went from one puppeteer to the next.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think he knew how to run the country, even as he got older.
Yeah.
So, obviously, Agrippina.
Mom.
I need a better name. Mom. Yep. She's not just going to take this sitting down.
Well, clearly not. I mean, she's done a lot.
She's like, I married an asshole for this.
I married my uncle.
For this. Come on, you are not just, like, going to kick me out that easy. And also, when it comes to, like, moms and their kids, sometimes throughout history, I'm like, what kind of, like, complex was this relationship? Like,
I had the thought with this. I was like, you guys seem weird.
I know. This seems a little,
a little emotional incest-y there.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what's going on.
Yeah.
So she kind of takes her revenge in a way by colluding and putting her kind of voice behind Britannicus, the same previous son of Claudius that they were worried about in the first place. Yeah. Yeah. Plot
twist.
Is like, oh, you weren't even just going to take this peacefully. You're like going to overthrow your son.
Betrayal.
Yeah. Like, really?
The drama.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
And so it's not like a blatant, like, I now stand for Britannicus, but, like, she's starting to, like, put her force there, like, her power that she still holds in the court and everything.
Jeez.
And you know how I mentioned that Nero did try to poison Britannicus before, probably?
Uh-huh.
Someone finally does it.
Oh.
Probably Nero. Oh. They're at a feast, and Britannicus just keels over.
Oh.
And he was poisoned. And Aggie Mom.
Uh-huh.
Is like, oh, well, I am next. This is not great. I know what's coming for me. And she knows, knowing that she's on the hit list and everything, she's a little paranoid, but she's careful. Again, this is like a lot of intrigue just for one royal court. Everyone's just killing each other here.
Jeez.
Like, I don't think I've had a single natural death listed, nor will I list a natural death, I don't think, this entire time.
Jeez.
Nero, literally, I guess he's not big on discretion, because he brings in a professional assassins from Alexandria. And I'm like, do you think your mom won't notice, like, the assassins you brought in from Alexandria?
Also, like, what is she going to do? Is she going to fight him off? Like, literally, you know?
Also, you could just set your guards. Like, but this is what makes me think that Nero was extra as hell.
Oh, we haven't figured that out yet?
I mean, I kind of knew based on the whole no one can leave my performance, and if they're, like, going into labor, but, you know, to each their own. Because I doubt a bunch of assassins just show up from the faraway land of Alexandria, which is not that far.
That happened to be in line with his goals.
Mm-hmm, and just happened to not like his mom and be really good at killing people, you know, whatever. So he wasn't just going to go in for a nice peaceful poisoning. Again, this guy's extra. It should not be surprising that he went all out, and I hope that this story is correct. I hope to God this story is correct. But there are reports that the original plan they created was to rig a sort of contraption in the ceiling of her chambers.
Oh my God.
And to essentially bring the roof down over her while she slept and crush her.
Oh.
And make it look like an accident collapse.
My God. Oh wow.
And I think the plan was too involved and they couldn't pull it off. I just really want to know about Nero, like this like 20-something-year-old guy sitting there like, hey guys, what's the most creative way we can kill my mom? But they don't pull that off because it's too outlandish. I hope that is true. I saw that in two places and I was like, okay, I'll write it down.
I'm just imagining, you know, like the meme with Gru where he's like with the board. It's like someone's like, and then we rigged the ceiling to collapse. And he's like,
Just kidding.
Oh my god.
Yeah, so they never even attempt that one because I guess they don't want to try and bomb in or blow in or drop in the entire roof on his mother.
Don't you wish they had, though?
Well, wait for it. So, it's not 100% foolproof. And installing it was really kind of also obvious. I feel like if you're laying in your bed looking at your ceiling, you would notice, like, a trap door sort of mechanism to drop the building on you.
What is that strange contraption?
That disappeared overnight.
In my roof.
So, instead, they create a collapsible boat.
Oh my god.
And they send her out on the boat.
Oh, this is...
And they have it collapse while she's on it.
Collapsible boat. And they Titanic this woman.
They tried, because you know what?
Did she survive?
She just swims back to shore. I don't know if she...
Surprise, bitch.
...can swim. I don't know if this was, like, they thought she couldn't swim, or they thought it would collapse maybe with her in it. Like, it would drop out the floor, right. Close above her like a trapdoor, and then pull her under.
Also, like, send her far enough away just in case she can swim.
I know. I'm thinking it was probably designed to, like, a trapdoor opens, she falls in, the whole thing sinks with her, like, trapped inside.
Yeah.
But, like, she just swims back to shore.
Oh, my God.
But obviously she knows at this point that someone's trying to kill her.
That just doesn't have to happen to boats. Yeah.
Yeah, and so eventually he realizes, like, these elaborate schemes might be, like, a great party trick, but it's not killing her, so he just hires someone to stab her. All that.
Hey, worked for Julius, so.
It did. Well, not in his favor.
Didn't work for him. Worked for everyone else.
Yeah. So, yeah, Mama's dead. Just got stabbed. After all that fanfare.
Hey, why overthink it?
I know.
Simple as bad. Yeah, no, why do all of that when you can just be like, hey, I've got a knife.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, stop hiring your fancy super people for Alexandria. Just turn around and be like, hey, who's loyal to me and who hates my mom? Anyone got beef with my mother? Because I will pay you to kill her. So, yeah, she's taken care of. Out of the way. But Nero's personal life is very rocky. He has a stepsister named Octavia. Emperor Claudius, you know, his stepfather, mm-hmm. his third wife, Messalina, that he murdered right before he married Nero's mom and all that. Mm-hmm. That marriage, his daughter was named Octavia.
Okay.
So this is Nero's stepsister.
And cousin.
Oh my God. this match was encouraged by his own mother while she was still alive. And so while his mother, like, his mother was the one that did this, was the one that set up this whole thing. And it wasn't uncommon, of course, to see familial marriages like this, especially when you're trying to keep bloodlines pure and all that. But this is, like, back before when his mom was alive, that he got married to Octavia.
Do you remember that show Life with Derek?
No.
It was, like, an old Disney or Nick show.
Oh, I never watched that one.
Allegedly, they had to cancel it because it was, like, about a girl who moved in with, like, stepdad and step-siblings.
Mm-hmm.
Allegedly, they had to cancel it because the chemistry between Derek, who was the stepbrother, the annoying stepbrother, and the main girl was, like, too much. So people thought they were dating. So they had to cancel it.
Oh, no. I never watched that show.
I feel like I watched a few episodes, but I was also a child, so I wasn't picking up on anything.
Yeah, no. You know? We were oblivious.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's basically, yes, what happens here.
The Life with Derek moment.
Yeah. So, he marries Octavia back... Ooh.
Bless you. Excuse me.
Thank you. So, yes. He's married Octavia back when his mother was alive and everything. But pretty much the whole time, he's been having an affair with a woman named Poppaea Sabina.
Okay.
The
whole time?
The whole time? Yeah, basically. And it's not exactly a kept secret, because Poppaea is pregnant.
Oh, yeah. That's hard to hide.
Yeah. And... he, of course, this, like, his mother did not like Poppaea.
Hmm.
Poppaea Sabina, what a name. But it seems that he fell in love with her, or at least as much as he thought he could, because he, like, wants to marry her. But he's already married to Octavia. So he's like, well, how do I get rid of a wife? I guess I don't really want to kill this one or whatever. So he just publicly charges Octavia with adultery. I do not know if she actually did. He was cheating on her, so she might have felt validated to cheat on him.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, this is ancient Rome, so
yeah.
Do you. But he sends her away to exile, which I'm like, oh, great. Didn't kill her. And I was, like, really excited. that he just sent her away to exile, but then I realized later he does have her murdered and covers it up as a suicide. Jeez. So not a win-win for poor Octavia. Imagine your step-sibling cousin husband. Wow.
Is Nero.
Is Nero, and then just, like, yeets you.
Jesus.
Like, you have to marry him, and then he kills you.
God, because he, like, decides he doesn't like you one day.
Yeah, exactly.
Jeez.
And so now he's free and clear to marry his mistress, Poppaea, who is also already married.
Oh,
to a
fun.
Roman soldier, and then the future emperor of Otho. And this creates a problem because she's, like, actively having an affair with Nero. So to get rid of her husband, Nero sends Otho away to the other side of the empire. And he's like, ah, I'll just take it for myself. So they manage to finagle a whole thing where they're allowed to get married. And there's some serious discussion about how much power Poppaea actually had. Because it seems like he genuinely did take her advice or liked her to some extent.
Huh.
Because he listened to her counsel. He let her exert a pretty large amount of power. It's thought that she had a hand in planning or encouraging Nero's mother's death. And remember, Agrippa didn't like Poppaea.
Interesting.
Agrippa had set him up with his first wife, Octavia.
God, this writes itself.
I know.
What are we doing these whole gritty?
Why are you, like, romanticizing this stuff? It already, like, is the...
It's there.
It's there.
The material is there.
Yeah. So, it's possible that she even had a hand in exiling his first wife, which, I mean, it makes sense. It's the mistress. She wants to get rid of the wife. It's like an old trope, oldest time.
Right.
But they eventually got married, since circumstances now allow it. But it does not necessarily go well. No matter how much Nero seemed infatuated or to trust her at first, Poppaea and him start having problems. I am more inclined to believe that Nero, this is when whatever was clinically obviously wrong with him,
was manifesting.
Starts getting worse.
Gotcha.
Because they have one kid together who does not live very long, unfortunately. And his volatile nature starts becoming very obvious during her next pregnancy. So much so that they are arguing one evening.
Oh no.
And he gets physically violent with her and kills her and the fetus with one kick to her stomach.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
A kick?
A kick or beat her so badly that she and the baby were dead.
Oh my god.
Yeah. That's, like, brutal. To kill your, like, wife, like, physically, not with a blade, not with, like, not having someone else do it. He did it. In, like, a fit of passion or whatever you want to call it. Like, passionate rage.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is, like, the first sign of, like, not, oh, I'm plotting this for the good of the realm because I feel like I have to because my advisors.
That is, like,
I am mentally ill.
There is something wrong with
something
me.
Something is wrong with me. And that's the first, like, one I saw where I was like, oh, shit. Like,
yeah.
Ooh.
Okay.
So, yeah. Child and Poppaea both gone.
Jeez.
That is in 62. Soon after that, he marries Statilia Messalina. I do not know if that Messalina name is the same as Claudius's third wife before Agrippina.
Okay.
I tried to kind of figure it out, but at that point, the family tree was getting very convoluted, and I just got confused.
Yeah.
But it is the same name. It's spelled the same, so they might be related. You're killing all these people. And that does not mean that you were exempt from assassination attempts yourself. Because this is when things just start spiraling for him. There's a whole conspiracy, of course, to try and kill him. Multiple assassination attempts. There's one very notable attempt called the Piso Conspiracy. A bunch of Roman senators got involved, and when it fails, Nero takes revenge by executing more than 40 of those people. Like, he starts going scorched earth.
I guess it doesn't always work for Julius.
Yeah, which, and this is too, is really interesting, because before he had talked about getting rid of the capital punishment. And so for someone who, and that begs the question, were his advisors the one preaching, like, golden age of prosperity and grace, and this is his true nature, or did something happen in there? Did he, like, actually become, like, mentally ill, or, like, what's going on?
Right.
It's very hard this far in the past to look at someone and make that, like, diagnosis of what happened, unfortunately,
yeah.
But it would fascinate me if someday we could, like, this, like, foremost scholars came to a complete agreement.
Yeah.
That'd be so cool. Yeah. Nero starts focusing on his personal pursuits, neglecting his work, so involved in arts and theater that he's very neglectful of his position. Even his tutors become tired of his antics and retire or die or start to give in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And he completely considers giving up the throne to become an artist.
Oh.
Like, he's that disinterested in the actual work that he fought so hard to have power in. Religion may play a factor as well. He got involved in some very small, like, sects, like, cultish, like, small groups.
Oh.
He was interested in, like, fringe religious movements, it seems. I don't know if he belonged to a singular one, but he has this whole beef with Christianity.
Okay.
And a lot of Christians kind of see him as, like, a, like, satanic figure, like, the Antichrist, basically.
Huh.
So the Christians are, like, not on board with Nero right now. And after all these attempts on his life, Nero starts to devolve. Like, paranoia out the, like, like, crazy. It's the him against the world, essentially, is now his mindset. And it's that's a chaotic mindset to have when you're the emperor of Rome. And as we discussed last week, with, like, Boudicca and everything, there are a few attempts all over the Roman Empire. I mean, there's always going to be dissent from other groups who are like, hey, stop colonizing us.
Yeah.
But he sees a few in these those gap years around Boudicca. It's not just her. There's a couple others that are notable enough where he's, like, facing actual turmoil in, like, his political sphere.
Yeah.
And colonization is not the only reason that people are rebelling, to be clear. Some of them don't like his rule anymore. They're starting to see him as a tyrant. He's starting to get away with things that they're like, hey, that was not chill. Or even just, like, increase of taxes. Like,
right.
People are just
a good old American way.
Yeah, yeah. Throw tea on that harbor. So one of the most notable stories of Nero's empire, his reign, I should say, is the Great Fire. The Great Fire of Rome is very sketchily and incongruently documented. Because there are some historians that, I mean, the famous story is that Nero played the fiddle while Rome burned, which is not historically accurate because fiddles weren't around.
Yeah.
Like, fiddles don't exist. He might have played the lyre.
The devil's not going down to Rome. Let's just say that. All right.
He was not looking for a soul to steal. I think Nero already gave up his soul to the devil at this point. Yeah. Killing your wife and unborn. Yeah. But it's even within historians, they don't, some of them don't even agree, like, where he was. This fire is a 6-day fire. It burned for almost a week. The fire started on July 19th of 64 CE. Nero may have started it.
What?
Oh, did you not know that's part of, like, the whole legend? That no. Nero set Rome on fire.
No.
Yeah.
Jeez.
But no one can agree.
Honestly, all I knew about him was that he was just really violent and not much more, so...
Okay, yeah, no, like, that's yeah. that's the, like, that he set Rome on fire and watched it burn.
Oh,
like, that's,
God.
Like, the, that's, like, when people talk about, like, Nero playing the fiddle, a lot of the times they use it in a, like, context of, like, self-destructive, because Nero kind of did it to himself. But historians don't even agree if he was in the city.
Oh.
It's crazy. So out of the 14 districts that make up that city, 10 of them burned. 3 were completely destroyed. About 7 were badly enough damaged that, like, they had to, like, rebuild to an extent. Mm-hmm. What didn't burn was looted, leaving hundreds dead, thousands without homes, and the city is just in complete disarray. Like, yeah. like all of Rome is in a disaster. they're, like, when I said historians at the time don't know, we still don't know. Like, this is... Every single account is different. There are some that say Nero ordered it, that Nero wasn't even in town, that Nero did it himself and went and played the fiddle while he watched it burn. Historians do not agree.
Jeez.
And it's thought, like, the one I saw most commonly advocated for was that he was in an entirely other place while Rome burned, or that he did not do it and he watched from his, like, villa. And just kind of stood over the burning city.
Right.
Either way you slice it, that's a big fire. It is literally called the Great Fire of Rome. So, I mean, the name is self-explanatory.
Great balls of fire.
Yes. There's a difficult historiography here, too. Because, as I mentioned, there are a lot of Christians at this time who do not like Nero. It is possible that some of those Christians had influence with historians or just the public perception And they were so mad at Nero that they spun it as, oh, look what he did. He burned the city himself. Gotcha. And it was like a smear campaign.
Right. Or like, it's his fault that it burned.
Mm-hmm.
He's so bad that it's his fault.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And so, I mean, Nero, there was a lot of mixed feelings about Christians, right, at this point. Like, there's some hatred for what people saw as unsavory traditions in the Christian practice at this point. So, like, that's a whole other... Christianity in ancient Rome is a whole topic of that I am not qualified. Even if I did research, I would not be qualified to talk on that.
And honestly, I refuse to.
So it's really hard to know, not even like, oh, the accounts don't match, but like what account would face what bias? Because no historian is going to approach the burning of Rome the same way, empirically. Right. You can't approach that empirically. Yeah. So after that, Rome needed to be rebuilt, honestly. They were having massive infrastructure problems before the fire. So after the fire, they're like, okay, we'll just rebuild bigger and better. We're talking better housing, better structural design. But that still comes with the requirement of some really big taxes. Because this is far more than his little emergency fund can cover. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this money is allocated to Nero's Golden Palace, or the Golden House, which is an exorbitant expense that included, like, gold on the ceilings, like, built-in lakes, exotic animals, the best and finest of all materials. Later, this entire palace, it never got finished as far as I could fully understand. It would be completely buried by another emperor.
Oh, my God.
I know. And I'm like, if we could just have a piece of it.
God.
I know. And that's why I think, isn't there a casino that's like Nero's Palace or whatever?
Caesar's Palace.
I know there's that one, but I feel like there's like a Nero.
I don't think there's a Nero one. It could be.
What am I thinking of? There's a reference somewhere in popular culture. Anyway, but when he rebuilt parts of Rome, he actually did it in the Greek style, which didn't sit super well with everyone. But we also know how the Romans and the Greeks like to, like, the Roman pantheon is just like the Greek pantheon, but better. And so that, like, Greek style would have dominated like 30% of the realm he was rebuilding. Like, that's a pretty big structural, architectural, cultural influence to impose upon the Roman people.
Yeah.
And that didn't sit well with everyone. And so a lot of people are like, this dude just rebuilt Rome as Greece, but, like, used our money to do it and built himself a palace in the process.
Yeah.
That doesn't sit well. Too, yeah, honestly. That doesn't sit well. So that's why some people were like, hey, he needed an opportunity, a reason to do this. Maybe he did set the fire. Maybe he wanted to burn Rome down. Was he so, and that's the question, was he so obsessed with the arts, with architecture and aesthetic, that he was willing to burn Rome? Because they had plenty of evidence that he was way more dedicated to his arts than he was to the people.
Mm-hmm.
They had plenty of reason to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
So as the distaste from his citizens kind of culminates into a very messy perception from the public, he is also more unbalanced in his mental health than he's probably ever been. He's devolving. He's paranoid that people are trying to kill him. I mean, as you kind of should be when you've also assassinated that many people. He's paranoid about the people he surrounds himself with, the religions that he's... It's a mess. And so when the Roman Senate officially declares that Nero is an enemy to the public, he's not... I don't think he's surprised, but it's still a huge, like, moment. He's a public enemy now. And they name another successor to overtake him as emperor. So there's no, like, hey, we need you to step down. This is like, hey, this is who's coming for your job.
No, actively, like, we are getting rid of you.
We are giving you your end date. Here you go. And there's this is writing on the wall for Nero. There's no money left. He spent it. There's people revolting against him. There's active assassination attempts. One of those assassination attempts included Seneca, his old tutor, who got caught up in the mess, and when he was found out, ended up committing suicide himself. Like I said, there's not a natural death, like, anywhere in this story.
Seneca Crane. Hunger Games, anyone?
You know your reference.
Been big on TikTok lately.
So Nero takes matters into his own hands, and he's like, well, I know it's coming. And he attempts suicide while at a villa, but apparently it doesn't work. So he ends up having to get help to do it.
Oh my God.
And
is that even considered suicide then?
I don't know, because they can't even agree 100% on how he died. I saw multiple accounts. A discussion about how it actually happened. I mean, that the Senate sentenced him to a death sentence of a slave, essentially, which is a cross with whipping. And he was like, nah, man, I'm not doing that. And that he may have tried to stab himself in the throat, or he tried to escape and got found out and they murdered him.
Gotcha.
Or like in more of an execution style. But we do, I mean, this is all happening on June 9th of 68 AD when he was only 30 years old.
You know, I feel like I knew that he died because my birthday is June 8th.
Oh, yeah.
And I feel I knew that he died on the 9th.
Yeah. So it's like, it's not, I don't think it's 100% agreed on how, but he died. We have the day. And supposedly, we have the last words.
Oh, I love a supposed last words. They're always so dramatic.
What an artist dies in me. He was committed to this aesthetic to the end. He wasn't even like, something about his empire, not his people, not I wish I had done them right, but just like, you're lost for the artist that dies with me. Like,
literally, okay. I get that the whole Julius Caesar assassination plot was really dramatic. Where's the Shakespearean play about this guy?
I know. Nero would, like, it come on.
Quite literally writes itself.
The whole thing does.
Shakespeare.
The whole thing.
Will.
The whole thing.
Buddy.
Come on.
What are we thinking?
I know. I could have, can you imagine Shakespeare's satire with this?
God.
Would have been beautiful. Beautiful.
Could you, I mean, imagine him trying to kill his mom in that boat or with the thing in her room.
I know. Think of how well that would go staged.
It would
be hilarious.
They probably, the boat would be hard, but they could have gone with the room thing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, no matter how he died, it starts, the next century is going to be full, like, the next few decades are just nothing but nonstop short-term kings or emperors vying for power with no, and there's so, the bloodline is so convoluted that they don't agree, like, who's really taking over in this. I believe he's the last of his bloodline. So, like, after this, it's a free-for-all.
Right, because there's no clear successor.
Yeah,
right.
And even if there is
and that causes
more than
problems.
One successor, they have about equal claim. Mm-hmm. And it starts one of the most chaotic periods in ancient history.
Jeez.
And so that is, like, quite crazy story.
Oh, man.
Of Emperor Nero.
Dude, you did so good. That
Thank
was
you.
So good.
Thank
I was
you.
In it. I was...
I felt really good
What's
about this one.
What's gonna happen next?
When I was doing this research, I was like, this is like the perfect story. Like, it's fun. It's got stuff you can
Drama,
laugh at.
Intrigue, humor.
And sifting through that information, I actually felt like I had a decent lineup today. Like, a cohesive.
Sometimes it's hard when it's like, there's not a clear, you know.
But I felt good about this one. So I'm good. I'm glad it came across good and fun.
Yeah, for sure.
Awesome.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Dude, that was awesome.
That's Nero. Yeah.
Good job.
Thank you.
Good bravo.
I had always known the whole, like, story about Rome burning, so I was really interested. I did not know how crazy, just the court assassinations alone, the family feuding bloodlines. I was like, oh.
You can't tell me that that's not at least a little bit Game of Thrones.
That's an HBO show waiting to happen.
Literally, what are we doing?
You know who would do an incredible...
Taika Waititi. Oh,
can you imagine a Taika version of this on HBO?
If they did, like, a workplace drama, but it's just, like, the Roman Senate.
Okay, I need Nero to be played by Taika, but we don't explain why he's dressed like a 17-year-old the whole time. we can go through Nero's, like, 17 to 30-year-old life, but it's just Taika in, like, different togas.
Oh, my God. Dude. I'm telling you,
actually,
yourself.
No. Taika would be a great Claudius.
Okay. What? If you are a Hollywood producer... We have given you so many phenomenal show ideas.
I know.
And honestly, we need to be paid for every single one of them.
Yes. It's like
those are all copyrighted. Saying that right now.
Yeah. Yeah. We are retconning right now. Mm-hmm. Everything we've ever said is copyrighted.
Never say a single word that we've ever said.
Nah, you can quote us. but give us credit. Yeah. But
give us credit. That's all I'm asking.
It's sad though, because there are some, like, what is it? 300 BC, that's supposed to be the story of, like...
300. Yeah. It's the story of the...
The Iliad? No, it's the Odyssey.
No,
it's Troy. It's
the battle
it's
of
the battle
whatever
of...
when... it's like, it's the 300 Spartans that held off the whole Persian emperor, or the whole Persian army.
Oh, I'm thinking like, Troy, the one with Brad Pitt or whatever. With that one, it made me like mad watching that. Yeah. I was like, you had a great story.
300 is like all gritty and dark, and they put this like weird filter all over everything. Like, what are we doing?
I haven't seen that one, but Troy itself, I remember watching it so excited because I was like, oh, I want to see this in movie form. I want to see and experience such a cool event. And then I was like, you added romance to what's just supposed to be a cool story.
I know. And my dad would like, we never watched it all the way through. But my dad does this thing where he'll, like, flip on a movie for, like, 5 minutes, and he'll be like, okay, moving on.
Yeah.
And 300 he always did that with. And then, like, when I learned about the actual, like, historical event, 300, I was like, oh, that's what my dad was always watching. Yeah. And, like...
It's sad, because it's like, it's you don't need to add anything to it. Doing? Just like, make it a good story.
I think, what's his name? Russell Crowe? Is that him in 300?
Yeah, I
Someone who looks like him. Something like that. I don't know. But I don't know what it is. They can't get, like...
I think they just overthink it. They try to hit every demographic instead of just being okay with hitting a history demographic.
They try to make it... Because there's broad appeal. A lot of people are interested in Greeks and Romans. A lot of people are.
Yeah.
But they try to make it like a man's movie. Because it's all about, like, warriors and stuff. That's not... No! Just make the movie!
Oh, it's Gerard Butler.
Gerard Butler. I always get them confused.
Lena Headey is the queen.
Really? Oh, it's been years I've never seen anything like that. Yeah.
Speaking of Game of Thrones.
Nah, see, George, we're on to you.
Oh, this is a stacked cast.
And it's like an okay movie.
Huh. Maybe I need to watch it sometime just to finally know what I'm talking about. Because
you'll see if you do watch it. And for those of you who have seen it, you'll know what I'm talking about. There is this like, it literally looks like a grainy filter all over all of it. And it's all, like, it's, like, sepia a little bit with, like, a grainy filter. It's, like, what are we doing?
Like, why are we here right now?
Why did you think Rome was, like, or Greek was, like...
Yeah, this is...
Greece was, like, that. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah, but...
Well, good job, regardless.
Thank you.
I saw the movie in my head, and that's what's important.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, man.
Wow. Okay.
So.
Very nice,
It's time for a little bit of a break.
Yes. Yes. Do you have anything you want to recommend
The
bat?
And it came to me as our friend dropped us off to record this.
Oh.
Kelly Clarkson, my girl, my queen, my first concert. Love you, babe.
Was that your first concert?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, wow.
I was 7, and it was great. Listen to my girl, Kelly. She's amazing. She's phenomenal. Her voice... She does covers now on her show.
Huh.
Beautiful.
Nice.
So, I love her. I've loved her for forever. So, that's part of why I'm always like, Kelly! It's not just like, oh, I respect her as a singer. I've loved her since I was, like, in elementary school.
That's
she was, like, the first, like, artist that I liked actively.
I love that.
Yeah.
Cool. So,
that's why I saw her.
I'm glad that she is, like, stayed.
Yes.
Like, with it.
I know. She makes me happy.
Persisted.
Yeah.
Awesome. My recommendation, because we were just talking about, like, movies that get all, like, distorted for the sake of Hollywoodism.
Yeah.
Find something, a topic, that you loved the history movie about as a kid, and watch a documentary on it.
Ooh, that's a good one.
And, like, see if you, like, however so much
like
you
like, if
remember...
you're super into the Titanic movie, mm-hmm.
watch an actual documentary. Yeah, like, try to see and pick out, like, what you recognize, like, what's real, and, like, because that's, I think, such a fun exercise that like,
fun.
I was doing it with a field trip I was giving a little while back, because they were young, and a lot of kids, I find, is really interesting how they process history right now,
uh-huh.
with the influence, because this generation is more than anyone is influenced by, like, media,
mm-hmm.
and so a lot of people, what they know about media,
is movies.
Or history is, like, yeah, it's media, right. It's movies, and so I was, like, in a classroom talking, and they had no clue what I was talking about, and I was like, I've got to try a different approach, and I was like, yeah. Hey, who's seen this movie, and they were like, all of them raised their hand, and I was like, okay, think about that time period. And what do we know very generally?
You gotta make it real to them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so that made me realize, like, we learn a lot from movies.
Yeah.
And we can't, since we unfortunately can't trust that directors do it right every time,
right.
Watch a documentary. Like, see
yeah.
what they got right and, like, what's
yeah.
what could be improved
Ooh,
on. So that's my recommendation for the week.
That's good.
Thank you.
Awesome.
So, yeah. Already, okay. I'm so ready for yours.
So I'm hoping to follow up these good vibes.
I'm ready.
With another bio.
Okay.
On another figure who was not... crazy. So
I'm, you know, we but had she a balance. She
was a fucking badass.
Oh.
So, okay. So I also did, if you listened to last week's episode, you might have mentioned me saying, or remember me saying that I would do the parade.
Yes.
With the lady on the horse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I looked into it, and the parade is just like a parade. Like, okay. There's a decently long, like, wiki article, which, like, I've said before, but, like, if I'm going to gauge, like, how long a topic's going to be,
yeah.
You can see how small that scroll bar is on the side of the wiki yes. article and be like, oh, that's too much. Mm-hmm. Or, okay, I could do that in an episode.
Or when you scroll to the index and it's one of its, like,
right.
Like, the other day when I was doing the spinning machines, a bunch yeah. of it was, like, years and patents. And I was like, oh no,
God.
We're not doing that.
Oh, God. Yeah. Wikipedia, great resource, has sometimes too much information.
Yes.
Really great if you need something niche and specific.
Yes.
The wiki article for the parade, it was just kind of like, okay, this is how they planned it. And this is like, there was like a whole section on like, this is their security they had. And I was like, this is not an interesting.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah. Okay. Girls, I'm so glad you did this, but I'm not doing this.
Yeah. If I had been there to experience it in person, I would have loved this.
Yeah.
But
right.
without the right. visual aspect of being right. there, I just can't get it. Yeah.
Yeah. So instead, what ended up being the much more interesting topic is the woman who rode the horse herself, a woman by the name of Inez Mill Holland.
Okay.
And she's really cool.
Okay.
So
I love that you've unearthed someone I've never heard about.
Yeah. Yeah. So she's actually in Iron Jawed Angels, which I know you've seen.
This is the first. Yeah. That's where I saw the parade for the first time depicted. Because when we talked about Ida B. Wells.
Yeah.
She's in Iron Jawed Angels.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Iron Jawed Angels, one of the, like, worst edited movies I've ever seen, but it's, like, genuinely a good movie, weirdly enough.
It was that phase.
They have, like, where PowerPoint transitions, but it's still a good movie.
Well, it was also that phase where they were like, we're going to make historic movies about girl power, but we're going to put modern music
they're gonna
in
they're going to make it cool and relatable.
Patrick Dempsey's going to show up for some reason.
Yeah. It's got Hilary Swank in it, which I always remember from that episode of The Office when they're, like, debating of whether or not she's, like, hot.
I have not seen The Office in forever.
Yeah, it's like, because that's all I know Hilary Swank from is like Iron Jawed Angels and then that episode of The Office.
Oh, yeah. I have one qualm. I know there's a couple facts that were not correct, but it really bothered me. There's a scene on a fire escape where Patrick Dempsey walks up with a sandwich. And because for some reason, I found out years ago that, well, Betty White, rest in peace, was older than sliced bread.
And he has sliced bread.
In the movie, he has sliced bread. And the minute I saw him walk up pre-suffrage with sliced bread.
Clean sliced bread.
I could not watch, like,
because you can tell if it's cut with a knife.
Oh, yeah. Too. Oh, no. It was like we're talking like white Wonder bread, cut bread. And I sat there and I was like,
wrong.
It was like the most minute thing I've ever caught in a movie. But just because for some reason I know about the year sliced bread was patented, I could not get it back in.
Oh my God. It took you out of it. That's
it
so
really
funny.
Did.
I don't even know if I noticed that, but you're right. Because sliced bread had to be the 30s because Betty White was born.
Yeah, 20. Oh, God, I had the year in my head. Hold on.
Was she born in the 20s? I don't remember.
No, she wasn't, but slight. Hold on.
Yeah, something like that. But yeah, so anyway, would recommend the movie. It's like one of those ones
1928 was the year. No, 28 was the year that they invented sliced bread.
Oh, okay. Because my great-grandparents were born in like 31 and 32.
Okay. Yeah. But I just remember seeing it in the movie and like, it was wrong. I was vibing with the movie, and for some reason that is the one detail. There's That's apparently so funny. There's a slight glitch too. There's like a flag on a wall that has all 50 stars on it, or
if
something
you
like that.
Ever curious about like historical inaccuracies, IMDb and they're like bloopers, or like they have like a section.
Yeah,
it's like bloopers, or it says something like that, like inaccuracies. Something like that. Literally, I made the mistake of going into that for That 70s Show one time. And of course, it's a sitcom, so it's like not accurate at all. And they're like, well, this episode is supposed to be based in 1973, and this didn't come out until 1977. And it was like, okay, I don't care about that. But
I watched for In Stranger Things.
Like, if you're ever curious about like period pieces and stuff like that, that's the place to find it. I love IMDb.
Yeah, but Iron Jawed Angels, it's like a decent movie and everything, but it's like, it killed me that the one time I was like, that sliced
That's
bread.
So funny.
It was just out of nowhere. Oh, I was like, gosh. Oh my God.
Okay, so I will not be mentioning sliced bread, so you can rest
okay,
easy.
Good.
So, Inez. Good old Inez. She was a baller, and I'm going to tell you all about her. So, She was born August 6, 1886, a good old Leo. And let me tell you, she is such a Leo. Do you know anything about the Leo personality types?
No.
Very outgoing, very charismatic.
Okay.
Very, like, star of the show. Like, a Leo is, like, superstar, basically. And you will definitely see that with Inez. She's from Brooklyn, New York, and she was raised in a very, very affluent family. She's the eldest daughter of her father, who was John Elmer Milholland, and her mother, Jean Milholland. She had one sister named Vita and one brother named John, who they called Jack. Her father was, he kind of did like a little bit of everything. His job was a New York Tribune reporter for a while.
That's a pretty high up there job.
Yeah. And so he was a reporter, and then he eventually was an editorial writer. And then they got really invested. You know, the tubes at the bank that like suck your little.
Yeah.
He got really involved in that.
Oh.
Business. And they made a shit ton of
I'm
money.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like.
Jeez.
I mean, it's the 1880s, right? So they're like.
Yeah. That's huge.
Newfangled technology.
Yeah.
Very wealthy to begin with. They were already pretty wealthy. And then when he was involved in that business, they made a lot of money. So she's very affluent. And this is kind of something you see her struggling with for the rest of her life. Because she ends up being like an advocate for a lot of people who have... Okay, so... Other than them being like affluent, they were actually a pretty unique family. And that the dad was like... super. So I listened to a podcast that described the dad as like an advocate for the underdog. So like any sort of underdog, like kind of in society, he was there advocating for.
Mm-hmm.
And this ranged from like African-Americans at the time to like Jewish people, women, just like anything. He was there and in support of. So he wasn't just like a rich asshole. Right. So like,
he wasn't totally self-involved.
Right, yeah. I mean, you know, eat the rich and everything, but... but and honestly,
maybe
like,
just snack on that
We're not talking, like, Andrew Carnegie here either. Right. Like, you know, they had money, but they weren't, like...
Two homes, not, like, owning Carnegie Hall.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, they didn't own it. They funded it, but yeah.
technicalities, Kat, come on.
Yeah, you're right, you're right.
So that was super unique, too. And her mom, honestly, was really unique in and of herself, too. She wasn't super outspoken, but she made sure that her daughters and her son received the same education. And she thought it was really important that her daughters be brought up in the same way as the son.
Hmm.
And this refers to, as I mentioned, education. But it also just refers to something, like, as simple as, like, it wasn't seemed appropriate or wasn't deemed appropriate for women to, like, go and, like, have outside time.
Yeah.
In the outdoors.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it was for men.
Like, literally, domestic is the place.
Literally, like they were in the home. And that was it. But she made sure that her daughters felt like they could explore outside and like were athletic and were involved in sports and all of this stuff. So, she had a pretty liberal upbringing, even though they might not have called themselves like, you know, anything flashy, but
compared
in
to
their
the other
own
people,
way.
Yeah. Of the position of that time.
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty cool. And obviously that has a huge, huge effect as well on her later life.
Mm-hmm.
So, she attends school at the Comstock School in New York. And once her dad, like, strikes it big with these, like, tubes, the family is actually able to make enough money that they're able to buy a home in London. And their mom...
That's bougie.
I don't know. Their mom really wants them to move to London because she wants to give her children, like, a classical European education, like, with culture and everything.
That's something only rich people can really say, but
I
yeah,
know,
okay.
Right? Okay.
I want them to get the European education, not the American one.
So while she's in London, and she's apparently, Inez is really excited to go to London because, like, she's 13, I believe, when they move. And what 13-year-old doesn't want to move to London? Like, to this day, you know? Like, that's, like, the dream.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, she's really excited. And while she's there, she attends the Kensington Secondary School in London. And she also is exposed for, honestly, the first time to suffrage. And suffrage in England
is
a whole other
different vibe.
Deal.
Like, if you don't know the difference between American and European suffrage, like, European suffrage, like, at least here in America, has a reputation for being the more physically aggressive and violent. Yeah. Like, the women were willing to do a lot more damage.
They got the job done, so.
They did. Well, Europe also dealt with slavery much earlier than America.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, and Europe just... Those countries are just really better at revolutionizing things. I'm just going to say it. The French, ever since they started just guillotining people, I think everyone was a little more scared of the French people.
French know how to revolt. And we've said this before, and we will say it again.
Your politicians should be a little scared of you.
They should.
Because they should. You have the power. The people just should have the power.
Remind them of that. Message to everyone in America.
I was about to say, that's a pointed comment.
So she's exposed to these ideas super early on, and they obviously catch her attention, which I don't blame her because of the upbringing she had. Like, yeah, you know, if my parents were into that, I'd be paying to those kind of attention to those kinds of things as well. So she finishes Kensington, and she decides she wants to go to Vassar. And the reason why she wants to go to Vassar, and this is something I didn't know about Vassar, is apparently it was founded by a guy who believed that men and women are both endowed by their creator with equal rights to education, specifically.
Interesting.
And so Vassar is, like, at the time, one of the few colleges in the country, especially at that level, that admit men and women equally and don't just admit women technically, but make them do, like, a lesser.
I didn't know
not
that.
As full. I didn't know it either.
That's like, I don't think I've ever heard of a school doing that on the Christian premise.
And that's the thing. It's the Christian premise about it. Because I don't really see.
I don't see many schools saying pointedly, we will be co-ed because we are Christian.
Yeah.
Not despite that we are Christian, but because
we are Christian. This is why.
That's interesting.
Yeah. It super, super is. So, understandably, she has her sights set on Vassar. But Vassar is like, ooh, the school you went to, even though your family is probably super rich and could send you to, like, the best school in London, they're like, we don't actually acknowledge your, like, graduation from there, so we're going to need you to do something else.
Your AP credits didn't transfer, sorry.
Literally. So she ends up going to the Willard School for Girls in Berlin, in Germany. And as excellent as she was at a lot of things, schooling was apparently not, like, the actual education part of it, like, classroom stuff, wasn't her whole, like, wasn't necessarily what she was great at. Mm-hmm. She said that she had to work really, really hard at school, but she was determined and she wanted to, because her end goal was to be a lawyer. She wanted to be a lawyer for a long, long time.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's pretty high aspirations for a woman in this time. Oh, it's shocking that a woman wanted it, but that, like, she was finding the inroads to do it, like, able to find the inroads.
Exactly. So good for her. She committed and she followed through. So she does eventually end up at Vassar. And Vassar, even though it has, like, you know, obviously it's founded with this ideal in mind, and so it's attracting a lot more, like, quote unquote, liberal thinking people, she is still known among her classmates as an active radical at Vassar. She is.
Oh, girl's really pushing the envelope.
She is. She brings a lot of these suffrage ideals back to Vassar with her. Like, this is in the States, from Europe. And Vassar at the time is, like, actively, I guess ignoring is the best word, the suffrage discussion. Okay. They're actively, like, being like, no, that's not happening here. We're not talking about that. We're not doing that. But she brings it to her classmates' attention. She organizes a women's rights meeting that she was suspended for.
Okay.
Girl committed. She organizes protests and petitions and even a whole suffrage club that was banned from meeting on campus. So they had their meetings at a cemetery across the road from campus.
What a baller move.
No. She enlists, eventually is able.
I would like to note that we've talked about it before on this podcast about how cemeteries used to be community spaces because they were attached to churches before.
Yeah.
I say we bring back.
Let's bring it back.
Community spaces and cemeteries.
Listen, the one that's close to us is gorgeous.
I walked through it the other day. Yeah. When I got off work, I was it was a nice day. And it was the day I had to deal with some emotional stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was I need a few minutes. So I just walked through the cemetery and it's so gorgeous. It's one of the few places in our town that has trees on both sides lining the roads, hanging over the park.
Gorgeous trees.
Beautiful benches. God. And it's quiet.
That reminds me. I have something to tell you. Don't let me forget.
Okay.
So eventually she essentially starts the suffrage movement at Vassar. She's eventually able to enroll 2/3 of the student body and teach them the principles not only of just how women deserve the right to vote. She also was a socialist, like a self-described socialist at this time. She was president of the Campus Intercollegiate Socialist Society, which was not just run by her, but apparently leadership in that was dominated by women in Vassar. So, like, hell yeah.
Okay.
She's quoted as saying that socialism was, quote, a vital means to correct the monster evils under the sun.
So this is a woman who's foregoing every expectation.
Yeah. And she went so far as to attend socialist meetings in other places that were under the ban of faculty. So she is, like, more than willing to violate whatever the faculty wants. Mm-hmm. Not only all of that, she was doing everything she could. I mentioned she was super into sports because of her upbringing.
Yeah.
She's described as, like, gorgeous. And okay. There are a lot of pictures of her, and she is. She also is tall. She is very athletic. She's got an athletic build. She was captain of the hockey team, member of the track team, sets a record in the basketball throw. She was involved in student productions like the drama club, the current topics club, the German club, and the debating team, on top of literally founding like suffrage clubs at the school and socialists and being the president of the socialist
club. Girl,
like,
she committed.
Is doing everything.
How do you spell her name?
M-I-L-H-O-L-L-A-N-D. Milholland.
Milholland.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And of course, I mean, we're seeing why she was chosen as the one to be on the horse, right?
Oh, she is pretty.
Like, she has got this, like, she, almost, her, like countenance. Goddess.
I was like, her, like, countenance. Yeah. She looks just so
regal.
Like, proud and poised.
I know. And everything I learned about her, I'm like, oh my god, I wish I knew you in real life.
Oh, this one of her young?
I know.
She's gorgeous.
I know.
Wow. Oh, she Wow.
Yeah.
She looks like she could, like, literally start a suffrage club, but also, like, have tea with her friends. And
listen,
just,
she can tell me to do whatever, and I would do it.
Like, I'm just really impressed with this woman. I would follow this woman into a suffrage war. I would.
Aye, aye, Captain. So in 1909, she graduates from Vassar, and as I mentioned before, she wants to be a lawyer, and she's got her goals, her heart set on that. So she applies for law school at Yale, Harvard, and Cambridge, but they all deny her on the basis of her being a woman.
They're of course.
We don't accept women.
Of course.
In her legal program now. So finally, she was able to get admitted to the New York University School of Law, and she does eventually receive her law degree and pass the bar exam and become a lawyer.
Okay.
As a lawyer, she is interested. Actually, when you look her up, it says that, like, she does labor law. She's interested, again, following in her dad's footsteps, kind of like the underdog.
Okay.
Whether that be labor movements, whether that be prison reform, whether that be women, all of the stuff she's super, super interested in.
Okay.
Prison reform, she kind of gets the taste for, because one of her first assignments at the law firm she's hired at, she has to go to Sing Sing and, like, do an investigation there. at this time, like, female contact with male prisoners was, like, super frowned upon, but she did it anyway.
Okay.
And she even had herself handcuffed to a prisoner because she wanted to, like, experience what that was like
wow.
to, like, live
Whoa.
As a prisoner. Yeah. yeah.
Girl.
So she could, like, really experience it.
Okay.
Yeah. She also is a really big advocate for Black American rights and all of this stuff at the time. So she kind of defies the stereotype of, like, the woman suffragette being racist.
Yeah.
At least so far as, like, what I come up with in my...
And we talk a lot about how a lot of the American suffrage movement was.
Yeah.
But I'm not saying... I want to be clear.
Not every individual one was.
Yeah.
The movement as a whole was.
There was a systemic issue there.
Yeah.
But there were a lot of... There were white women that did actively support intersectional suffrage.
Yeah. On top of all of that, she was... Let me get my voice ready. She was a member of the NAACP, the Women's Trade Union League, the Equality League of Self-Supporting Women in New York, which is also known as the Women's Political Union, the National Child Labor Committee, England's Fabian Society, the National American Women's Suffrage Association, the NWP, like... and she worked with Alice Paul and Lucy Burns. Like, she is, wow, like, all of these big names.
She's in the place for it.
High profile. She is.
She's like, physically, geographically in New York. Yeah. Like,
and she's taking advantage of that. And, like, good for you, Queen, because she's doing the work. As I mentioned earlier, her first position as a lawyer is at the Osborne, Lamb & Garbin firm of law in New York. And this is the one who gives her the assignment of going to Sing Sing. Mm-hmm. And this is where she realizes, like, a passion for prison reform, all of this stuff. And she doesn't actually get super involved. She is involved with the suffrage movement, but the first time we see her in a suffrage parade isn't until 1911. So on May 7th, 1911, she is involved in her first suffrage parade. She holds a sign in that parade that says, quote, "Forward out of error, leave behind the night, forward through the darkness, forward into light." Pretty soon after that, because of just her personality, her countenance, the way she looks,
yeah,
she becomes like the face of the suffrage movement. And she is, until we see her on the horse in 1913.
I really like that last line, forward into light.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love that.
The New York Sun even stated that after this parade that, quote, "no suffrage parade was complete without Inez Milholland."
Like, imagine just being the suffrage parade
of the movement. Jeez. Yeah. So, of course, she participates in parades throughout 1911, 1912, and into 1913. And then we have her most famous parade on March 3rd, 1913, which happened to be the day before President Woodrow Wilson's inauguration. Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
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 Sometimes when I think of dates, my brain still goes,
I know, like... I know. And they chose this date specifically because, mm-hmm, at the time, this was the largest and, like, first time that someone had a group had intentionally marched on Washington.
Oh.
For a political reason.
Okay.
So this is the first one in line that we see, like, MLK's march on Washington.
Yeah, like, the march on, like, a right. march on, yeah.
All of the, any protest that has marched on Washington. This is the first one. Wow, this is the
first one.
One.
Okay.
That we see. And she's, like, the figurehead of this moment.
Wow.
Not only is she involved in the parade, she actually helps organize it. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the parade itself, as in, like, who's doing what in the parade, because this is a huge deal. Estimates range from anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 women just marching.
Wow. In the parade. Okay.
Yeah. So.
And we talked about this week, about TikTok being a great asset to mobilize, mm-hmm, people, because, like, you can communicate through it. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to think of that many women able to coordinate.
I know.
Through letters, through talking in the streets, through meetings and newspapers. Like,
you just had to have, like, okay, I'll be there.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, not, ooh, is it happening? And what should I wear?
And then networking. The these women, a lot of them heard about it from either, like, individually printed papers or word of mouth.
Right. Exactly.
Like, that's crazy.
Yeah. So the parade opened with Jane Walker Burleson on horseback, who was carrying, or was accompanied by a model of the Liberty Bell from, like, the, just a model of it, but she was the Grand Marshal. So she opened the parade. She was immediately followed by the herald of the parade, which was Inez. Inez wore a pale blue cape flowed over. It says, or an article says, quote, "A pale blue cape flowed over her white suit, held on by a Maltese cross. Her banner proclaimed, quote, 'Forward into light,' a phrase originated by Emmeline Pankhurst."
In that first parade
she was in.
Emmeline Pankhurst.
Yep.
Talk about aggressive women.
And if you have not seen pictures of this woman in this parade, because she is channeling, like, goddess.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking, like, Valkyrie. I'm, like, woman warrior.
Oh, just, she,
like,
just looks white, so cool.
Horse. She is, oh, she is doing it. And, I mean, obviously, she's gorgeous, too, so it's just.
But that white horse really, I mean,
it makes a statement. Also, there's a reason why last week we were like, oh, the lady on the horse.
Yeah.
And we knew exactly what we were talking about, you know? Yeah.
But, like, her hair, I don't know how it's that perfectly curled. Like, I'm really jealous that she's on a horse and looks that good doing it.
I know. Immediately behind her, there was a wagon that stated, quote, "We demand an amendment to the Constitution of the United States enfranchising the woman of this country." Not only did all of this happen, but apparently the planners imposed, like, a color scheme for, like, each group participating in this parade. And so it would, like, eventually, like, be a rainbow passing by. Mm-hmm. They also, so it says, quote, Alice Paul recruited 26 floats, 6 golden chariots, 10 bands, 45 captains,
jeez,
200 marshals, 120 pages, 6 mounted heralds, and 6 mounted brigades,
jeez,
mounted brigades throughout the parade.
And
again, I'm talking 5,000 to 10,000 women participating.
Jeez.
So the first section passed, like, the openers of the parade, were women from countries that already had the vote. This included Norway, Finland, Australia, and New Zealand. The second section had floats that depicted historic scenes from suffrage movements, like, in the 1840s through the 1890s. And then we have, like, a series of floats depicted men and women working side by side in home at various professions. There's even one float with a man that held a representation of government on his shoulders while a woman with hands tied stood up helpless at his side. There was a float that depicted nurses, like, followed by a marching group of nurses to show, like, the impact that women had. Groups that depicted traditional motherhood roles and homemakings that, like, were still work. Professional women, including, like, again, the nurses group, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, and the PTA. Lawyers, artists, and businesswomen. All of these. And just, like, references to Abraham Lincoln and all of these, like, movements for people's rights and all of these things. Like, this was a huge, jeez, massive orchestrated, yeah, float or parade, not just to mention that they had, like, this whole color scheme going, so,
yeah,
they were, like, in rainbow order to, yeah, like, really make a visual impact, which is why when we have Milholland on a white horse in all white,
that's,
it makes
such a striking,
such a striking thing, and you,
yeah,
have the, all of these bright colors behind her. Like, oh my god,
it's blinding in the pictures.
Yeah, yeah. So Milholland's own belief in, like, the right of women's suffrage was says, like, she was said to believe, like, not only just in, you know, in the individual right of women, but she genuinely believed that, like, the woman's voice and perspective would be very valuable to the nation as a whole. She thought that women would come or become, quote, the house cleaners of the nation. And I kind of took a while to, like, interpret that quote. What I think she means is that, like, women hold this, like, moral standard in the home, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think she's applying that to a nation as a whole.
Okay.
Whereas, like,
oh, I see,
you know what
saying.
I mean?
Yeah, like, not more, like, oh, woman's duty.
Right,
like,
they're not,
yeah,
going to clean house. More,
right,
like, they're going to be, like, the moral compasses,
yeah,
and the guides for all of the nation.
Ah,
and while, you know, we might not agree with that now, like, this is
1913, also,
like, 1909.
We're also near the temperance movement,
right,
still,
exactly,
too, and everything. And
yeah, and so these early views on women, and you can't really blame them for that, because, you know, this first wave feminism. So,
yeah.
She also believed that women's votes could help remove social ills such as sweatshops, tenements, prostitution, hunger, poverty, and child mortality. She thought that, like, if women were able to be involved in the vote, like, vote, a lot of these social problems that were afflicting this nation could be taken care of, because women cared about them, whereas she perceived that, like, men didn't.
Mm-hmm.
So, all of that is to say, she obviously was a very intelligent woman. She was a lawyer. She did all of these things, like, hugely personally accomplished, or, like, very accomplished.
Mm-hmm.
But she kind of always remarked about how, like, no matter what she seemed to do, it was always, like, her looks that came first. And, of course, we talked about how beautiful she was. And
yeah,
that's not to say, that's not to detract or detract from anything
does, yeah,
that she's done.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she really had the idea that, like, at the time, it was kind of detracting from the work that she was actually doing.
Mm-hmm.
And you could kind of see
this. It's like the downside of pretty privilege. Like,
right,
people don't take you as seriously,
exactly,
because they're
focusing on her looks instead of, like,
mm-hmm,
her actual knowledge and kind of clout. So I wanted, with that in mind, I wanted to take this time to kind of focus on who she was as a person. She was very much, like, the ideal of that early 1900s, turn of the century, new woman. She was the one on the bikes. She was,
mm-hmm,
the one with the Gibson girl haircut.
Yep.
Like, she was doing it. She was probably the ones wearing, like, the harem pants instead of the skirts. Like, she was that girl. You know what I mean? She loved any new dance crazes. She was super sociable, if you hadn't noticed. She loved specifically the turkey trot and the grizzly bear. So if you know old school dances, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
My cat's chewing plastic and he doesn't need to. She was very, like, sexually free. She had a lot of, like, quote-unquote lovers, but, like, kind of turned them all down. I was like, no, until one, like, really caught her attention.
Sounds like she could choose to be selective.
Oh, yeah. In 1909, we have her first one that kind of caught her attention by the name of Max Eastman. He was very handsome. She was very beautiful. So it's kind of like they became really popular. And she even met him through his sister, Crystal Eastman, who she knew through socialist and suffragist circles.
Mm-hmm.
So that, like, presumably he was kind of in agreement with those ideals, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't think she would accept anything less. And so allegedly she told him that she loved him and wanted to elope with him. And he was like, I don't know. But when he finally was like, I love you, she was like, I'm over it.
She's like, I waited for you. I can't wait forever.
Too late. They did remain lifelong, lifelong friends, though, aww, allegedly. So,
well, I like to hear that.
Yeah, that's nice.
Acknowledging you're not in the same place at the same time, but you're still friends. Yep. That's nice.
So she also has another love with an author named John Fox Jr. Same thing, same kind of deal. She told him she loved him. He didn't reciprocate super quick. And so she's like, nah, once he finally came around.
I'll find someone who does.
It's fine. You know what? I've moved on. So don't even worry about it. And it wasn't until 1913 in July when she was on a cruise to London when she meets a man named Eugen Jan, this is German, Boissevain, or sorry, Dutchman. He was Dutch. Boissevain. I'm going to say that. Boissevain. Boissevain.
Okay.
Boissevain. It's got to be Boissy, right?
Okay.
I'll trust. And she falls, like, head over heels. Apparently, on the cruise to London, she proposes marriage to him more than once. And he's like, nah. But eventually, he's like, yeah, we'll get married.
Wow. Girl works fast.
Yeah. So, pretty soon after they arrived in London on July 14th, at the Kensington Registry Office, they were wed. And, like, they couldn't even consult their families. And they just, like, ended up nailing their parents. Be like, hey, by the way, I'm married. And apparently her parents were like, eh, we trust your judgment. So
that is a lot of trust. Okay,
if she wants to marry this dude, we'll trust her. Yeah. There was kind of tricky, though, because apparently at the time the United States had a law that if a woman from America married an international citizen, that she would essentially lose her rights as an American citizen be a citizen of the country of the man that she married.
Are you kidding me?
Right? Like, that's so stupid. What do you mean? What do you mean?
You're your husband's possession, so you lose all autonomy.
So you, like, are now a citizen of that country.
You're not a citizen. You're a possession of that country.
Like, are you telling the Dutch that, hey, this is person that now is a citizen of yours?
Like, they have to belong, so they have to be a citizen of somewhere.
I know. Jeez. Oh my gosh. So anyway, yeah, she, like, uses her connections to sue about it, and, like, try to change the law, but it, like, doesn't really work. So
I mean, if anyone could be a lawyer like her, but, like, there's a certain amount of inevitability to the American political legislative system.
I think she's able eventually to work it out, because she is able to, like, live in America again, or at least say, like, apply for citizenship, something, something. She works it out. Anyway, so after 1913, we see her less involved in suffrage. For whatever reason, she kind of steps away from that. And I think it's the advent of the war. It kind of draws a lot of her attention. so much so that she... pretty soon after the Lusitania is sunk, she is able, or she, like, boards a ship to Italy and goes to Italy, to, like, be a reporter, on, like, the war.
Right? Following her dad's footsteps, I guess.
I guess so. She is able, so she's writing for the New York Tribune, And even becomes like a war correspondent, but she like has to go to Italy first, get the information, and then send it back to America.
Interesting.
And then they're like, okay, yeah, we'll hire you as a correspondent.
Not like I'm already here.
Yeah. whatever way, I guess it works out for you. So she is like now a war correspondent. However, she's like not able to be on the front lines because she's a woman, and she works to be allowed to, but like the Italian government does not like her and like bans her articles that she was writing and then eventually bans her from the country. So she returns to America and she's like really upset. She's like, I feel like I didn't get to do anything. This is really frustrating. And so she gets involved with a little pet project that Henry Ford is doing called the Peace Ship Expedition of 1915. Which is basically, he brings together a team, quote unquote, of pacifist campaigners that were going to go to Europe and stop the war, right? This like weird, bizarre project that like, I'm sure if you're like there at the time, you're like, and then you're an American, you're like, yeah, this could like, work.
Okay. But no. But
like,
no.
Also like, it's still early years of the war. We don't know how big of a deal it is yet. And it's really easy for us to see like, okay, that's never going to work.
Mm-hmm.
So she goes over back to Europe with them, and they reach Stockholm, and the troop is just incredibly unorganized, incredibly, from the beginning. Different passengers, like, don't like each other, they have, like, issues with each other, they fight.
House divided cannot stand.
I know, and, like, not even just to mention that it's just unorganized from the beginning, and then Henry Ford, before they get to Europe, just, like, dips. He's like, okay, I'm not doing this anymore.
Bye.
And so, of course, that means it's just, like, more and more. So, like, I feel like she's really trying to get involved with, like, the war effort and, like, anti-war and, like, all of this stuff.
She saw it as, like, the prominent issue.
Right. And it is, so I understand why she's attracted to it, but she doesn't quite know how to get involved in those movements.
Yeah.
Which I don't blame her. It's hard to get connected and involved, especially because it's 1915.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure she heard about something that she could do to, like, help. And so she jumps on it because that's just seems like the kind of personality she has.
Yeah.
And then it's like, you know, I mean, she put herself in a boat to Italy to go try to help. And then Italy bans her. Mm-hmm. And that's not really her fault, you know?
Yeah.
So she's doing what she can. Eventually, she kind of realizes, like, okay, maybe the war is not the place for me. So she goes back to campaigning for suffrage in America. In 1916, she launches this huge tour just across America, and it is incredibly, incredibly hard on her and her body. This whole time she had suffered from like pretty intense anemia.
A nasty one.
Yeah, so this tour is really, really hard on her. I couldn't find an article verifying it, but the podcast that I listened to about it, I think she is aiming to speak in all 50 states in 28 days.
Oh my. Wait, yeah. How? Physically, how?
I know. And so it's like,
you'd have to hit two states a day.
And no, I know.
And get across an ocean.
I know. Yeah. So hugely, hugely intensive speech rally. Even if I miss her, the podcast, and it was like 38 days.
That's still
really ambitious.
That's crazy.
I mean, 50 states in 50 days. That's a lot.
That's more than like a politician would do.
Yeah, exactly. So, but she's dedicated to this cause, and she is an electrifying speaker, and she is, like, the prominent speaker of the suffrage movement, right? Like, they need her. She is good at what she does. She rallies people. She encourages people. And so they need her, and she feels needed, and she feels involved, and she feels like she's doing for good. So she wants to be involved in this, even though her health isn't well-suited for this job, right? So she makes it all the way to California. And she's delivering a speech in Los Angeles in the fall of 1916. And she, like, directs it at the president. And at the speech, she collapses in 1916.
Oh.
She's rushed to the hospital. And she's treated for her severe anemia. And they even hope that she recovers. But she dies a couple weeks later on November 25th, 1916. Yeah.
Whoa. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
From the complications of anemia?
Mm-hmm. And from how intensive this tour was.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Like, it's really interesting, to, like, knowing now what we know about medicine and everything, but, geez, right. even Wow.
And apparently she had been taken to the doctor earlier in the tour, and they were like, well, it looks like you have this, but we're not really worried about it, so you can wrap up your tour and you'll be fine. Ugh. And then it was worse than they realized, and that's kind of what led to the complications.
And she sounds like the kind of woman that would start feeling like dizzy and sick and wouldn't say anything, because she's more worried about the work she's doing than her health.
Yeah. So Alice Paul organizes a memorial service for her that was held in Statuary Hall at the U.S. Capitol building on Christmas Day that same year in 1916. And her concluding words of her very last suffrage speech were, quote, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty?" And unfortunately, she does not live to see the 19th Amendment.
That's her line?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I've heard that so many times. I didn't realize that was hers.
So I think after this, she really becomes like a martyr for the movement, because she was such a figurehead and such a visible. And she literally collapses during a speech.
Yeah.
So that is the story of Inez Milholland.
Wow.
I know, right?
That is an accomplished woman.
What a woman.
Like, if your life is going to end, unfortunately, early.
Mm-hmm. I mean, she was born like, in, I think, 86. And this is
1916.
She's like 30. In her
Nero was 30. Wow, we both picked 30-year-olds today.
Ooh, 27 Club. Anyone? Yeah. Jeez.
That's... And I feel like if you... I mean, there's that whole discussion about, like, would you rather live a shorter life full of purpose and change, or, like, a long life? And I feel like she, I mean, if she knew her health wasn't in the best, even if she didn't know how bad it was, and she kept going, I think she would have been very okay with having such a, such a
I think she was
productive
probably,
young life rather than do nothing at all with it. That's
And it's such a shame, too, because... You know, imagine the change
she could have enacted, and
she was, because from day one she was an advocate for everyone,
right?
Like, if she had survived to see the civil rights movement, she would have been in her 60s.
Whoa! Oh wow, that's my brain. Of course, you know? Chronology.
Yeah, I mean, maybe 70s, but like, she would have been doing it, you know. Sorry, Appa's being crazy because he's bored. But it's just such...
And, I know.
You know, it's not her fault, but it's such a shame.
It really is.
To see a flame that burns so bright, you know, it is kind of true, like, you know, they're going to burn quickly, too.
Yeah.
So, but anyway.
But this she's fantastically interesting.
I hope you see why I chose her instead of just the parade.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely do. Yeah. That's awesome.
So she was... A badass, a baller,
that,
all of those things.
She really was. That's insane.
Yeah. So
I'm really glad you chose her. You did a really good job with that.
Thank you. Thank you. I had fun.
That's a busy life to cover. An accomplished life to cover.
And just, you know, she wasn't even that old. So I know. I was like, we're already at 46 minutes of me talking. And I'm like, God, could you imagine if she had lived longer than this?
We would have this would be a two-parter.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So wherever you are, Inez, hats off to you, girl.
Yep.
You were queen.
Yep.
Yep.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So.
Wow. Well, we got two pretty heavy hitting topics.
Yeah.
30 years of 30-year-olds who
shut things up.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, if there's any other 30-year-olds who shook things up that you'd really like to hear about, you can always tweet at us at TINAHL Podcast.
What a great segue.
Thank you.
Can email us at thisisnotahistorylecture@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. We're always open to hearing what you want to hear from us, especially there's a lot going on in the world right now. Like, revolution-wise, everything from revolutions to getting, like, TikTok banned and freedom of speech. If there's topics you want to hear about, like, please tell us.
Hey. I had thought briefly I would do another topic, but maybe next week I'll save it for.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to talk about Pluto and Aquarius because I'm already giving Kat the spiel.
Yes.
Tune in next week to hear about that because I think it is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
It says a lot about a lot of different things. So, yeah.
I don't understand what she was really talking about. Like, I get it conceptually. I don't understand it analytically, but I get where she's coming from, and it was really cool.
So maybe we can talk about it more next week.
So, if there's stuff that you want to hear about to understand the world context, please let us know. And we'd love to help you with that. Please leave a review wherever you might listen to us. Yep. Every review you leave is one more not muggy day for Cal.
There you go. And one more muggy day for Kat.
This is a win-lose situation. At odds.
It's like, I think it would be hilarious to put like a, and I'm not the first one to think of this, but the concept is so funny to me. A humidifier and a dehumidifier in a room together.
And just sit in front of, yeah.
And see who wins. That's so funny.
That's fair, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Battle it out.
Battle royale, yeah. So yeah.
Oh, man.
Reviews are super helpful to us. So thank you all for listening.
Yep. We love you. We appreciate you. And we'll hit you next week with some more history.
Yeah. And just a reminder, you know, that this whole thing we've been talking about, it has not been
a history
lecture.
Oh my God.
Bye.